Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida is in the midst of an affordable housing crisis, and some lawmakers are trying to stop their cohorts from making it worse.
The intent of the bill, the same as Senator Mayfield's SB 306, is to stop the normalization of sweeping the housing trust funds.
Also this week, the president of the Florida Senate shares his preview of the upcoming lawmaking session.
We have work to do. We want to be productive, and we're going to be about our business.
We'll also chat with the new head of the First Amendment Foundation and do our best to learn how the state might actually take action to mitigate the effects of climate change. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. There's an affordable housing crisis in Florida, and housing advocates believe the legislature isn't taking it seriously. Over the past two decades, more than $2 billion has been stripped from the state's housing trust fund. As Blaise Ganey reports, some lawmakers are now trying to limit the sweeps, while others are looking to continue the practice.
The Florida Housing Finance Corporation is the agency that allocates affordable housing funds for the state. The director of multifamily allocations, Marissa Button, says in recent years they haven't had enough to cover the need in the state.
We always have more applications statewide than the amount of funding usually that we have to give, so we have a competitive process.
The reason for the lack of funding isn't because the money isn't there, but rather because the money is being spent on other things. The money comes from taxes from construction and home sales.
Sensible as it seems to the everyday person in the state, that the housing trust funds should be used solely for housing, we continue to see an annual sweep of millions of housing dollars.
That's Jamie Ross, president of the Florida Housing Coalition, a statewide nonprofit housing group. She has one message for lawmakers: use housing trust fund money on housing.
In one year, like this year, if all the housing trust fund monies is appropriated for housing, it creates 30,000 jobs and over $4 billion in positive economic benefit.
But House Appropriations Chair Travis Cummings says sweeps are likely to happen again.
I think we probably just to roll out a responsible budget on the House side, we'll probably take a hard, serious look at sweeping at some level.
This year, members on both sides of the aisle have filed bills to try and stop the sweeps. Winter Haven Republican Sam Killebrew is the House sponsor. He lives in Polk County. Last year, the county was awarded $1 million for affordable housing. If the program was fully funded, they would have gotten $8 million.
The intent of the bill, the same as Senator Mayfield's SB 306, is to stop the normalization of sweeping the housing trust funds so that we can help Florida's workforce, our elderly, our veterans, and people with disabilities living in fixed incomes and live in safe housing that they can afford.
Cummings doesn't like the idea.
Probably would be irresponsible for the legislature to tie, particularly future legislators' hands.
But the Housing Coalition's Ross says it wouldn't completely tie their hands.
If there was an emergency and the legislature needed these funds, like a Great Recession, for instance, they could still be used. So what it does is it elevates the housing trust funds to a place that, for instance, the transportation trust funds are in right now.
She points to what happened earlier this year when the legislature took money to help with Hurricane Michael recovery.
But I think more importantly than that is that after the $115 million went to the panhandle, $125 million was swept to general revenue.
That left the housing trust fund with roughly $80 million to go toward affordable housing needs. The debate over what to do with the housing money will continue throughout the session. I'm Blaise Ganey.
Oh, Over coffee and breakfast, Florida Senate President Bill Galvano gave reporters a last look ahead to the legislative session as lawmakers go to their respective homes for holiday break. Ryan Daly was on hand to hear the outgoing chamber leader cover a laundry list of topics.
Galvano addressed Senate priorities, gave his take on a state agency lobbying for its own existence, and talked a controversial plan to build three toll highways, his brainchild from last session. As the leader of the Florida House calls for the state tourism wing, Visit Florida, to be dissolved, Galvano told reporters he sees value in the agency. Critics say the Sunshine State markets itself by way of its reputation as a tourist destination. But Galvano says Visit Florida goes beyond just enticing visitors.
There are certain things that we do have to message and mitigate. For example, whether it's Zika that cost our tourist industry millions, tens of millions of dollars. You have red tide issues, algae, hurricanes, things that are important to re-message or explain. Just a straight up advertising, come to Florida, I would agree with you. We have private business interest who do a good job of that on their own.
Speaker of the House Jose Oliva wrote a strongly worded editorial calling for Visit Florida to shutter earlier this month. In it, he calls the agency a waste of the $30 million the legislature funded it with in the 2019 session. Another hot topic leading into the 2020 session is education spending, particularly teacher pay. Governor Ron DeSantis is billing 2020 as the year of the teacher, but Galvano says he's wary of the state trying to take a one-size-fits-all approach to raising teacher pay. That's in response to DeSantis' pitch to boost starting teacher pay to $47,500, an investment of roughly $600 million. Galvano says teacher pay is best left to localities, and last year's increase to the base student allocation, flexible funding for districts, allowed many to give educators a pay bump.
It is a local issue. It truly is. And when we increased the BSA as we did last year, one of the initial things that we did was look at what districts actually did increase pay. And we were pleased to see that a majority did. So, you know, I'm cautious about us owning that issue at the state level. So that is part of the analysis that's taking place.
Galvano acknowledged different districts have different levels of pay for teachers and different costs of living in their areas. He says Republican Senators Manny Diaz and Kelly Stargell, chairs of key education committees, are trying to figure out a plan to give districts autonomy in raising pay. A number of reporter questions lobbed at Galvano were concerning the massive project to build three new toll roads to run up what he calls the rural spine of the state. The Senate president isn't giving much credence to a federal Fish and Wildlife Service biologist's claims that one planned road will greatly endanger Florida panthers. The Tampa Bay Times reported the biologist was referring to the road that would run through the center of the state, up from Collier County and into Polk County. Galvano, amid widespread criticism of the project from environmental groups, is defending it.
I believe it's a completely overstated, and I've emphasized that as part of this program, we have to be cognizant of the environmental impacts. And so the answer is no, we're not going to destroy the environment for the sake of particular infrastructure.
The Times reported that the biologist's claims were made in emails obtained by a nonprofit environmental advocacy group and that the federal agency hasn't endorsed its employees' statements. The National Wildlife Federation says there are only about 130 Florida panthers left in the wild. Galvano's meeting with the Capitol Press Corps came amid the U.S. House of Representatives impeachment proceedings. Just a day before the House voted to impeach President Donald Trump, Galvano said he doesn't think impeachment will have any effect on party relations in the state legislature heading into the 2020 session.
We operate focused on issues that are pertinent to the state. The relationships within the Senate are strong, and Republican and Democrat alike. I work well with Leader Gibson. And, you know, it's really not filtered down here. It's, you know, we have work to do. We want to be productive, and we're going to be about our business.
Lawmakers will convene for the 2020 legislative session on January 14th. I'm Ryan Daly.
Still to come on Capitol Report, in a surprising policy reversal, state government in Florida seems willing to finally address climate change, but uncertainty remains on how to do that.
If you were a young couple that was taking out a 30-year mortgage in Tampa Bay, by the time you paid off that mortgage, the sea level rise would have likely risen 1 to even 2 feet.
Opioid addiction is tough regardless, but imagine having to go many, many miles from home to find treatment.
It does provide a huge barrier when you have to every morning get into your car and drive somewhere to be dosed on your medication.
The new leader of the First Amendment Foundation is ready to tackle public records and misinformation.
The news is coming in small sound bites, and if you want to know more about it, you have to dig deeper.
And the man who led the ascendancy of the Republican Party in Florida government has now switched parties because of the person now in the White House.
He sensed the rot in the Republican Party and hijacked the party of Ronald Reagan.
Florida lawmakers are interested in addressing climate change, but they're not setting any sort of renewable energy goals, which is something Democrats have proposed in the past. Instead, the Republican-led majority is focusing on making the state more adaptable to rising sea levels, and as Lynn Hatter reports, lawmakers are outlining plans to shore up the state's infrastructure with that in mind.
Florida's Chief Resilience Officer Julie Neshwat is focusing on a statewide strategy for addressing climate change. She recently told a group of business people the state's primary threat from climate change is sea level rise.
Our state is surrounded by water, and 80% of our residents live on the coast. We face many resiliency challenges, as you can imagine.
Among those challenges, the state's roadways, highways, houses, and buildings.
For example, we have over 2,500 miles of roads that are about 3 feet below the high tide line, making them prone to flooding. So since back to 2005, Florida homes have lost over $5 billion due to flooding.
And the water will keep coming. Earlier this month, the Senate's Tourism and Infrastructure Committee took a step toward addressing the threat of sea level rise. Florida is vulnerable, and local governments, especially coastal ones, are already trying to find ways to adapt.
I'm not a scientist either, but I do see that we have some changes taking place in our climate that seem to be resulting in changes in our sea level, and we're putting putting billions of dollars into the infrastructure of this state every year, and it seems like we ought to have some sense and some indication of where we might be relative to our current tide levels 50 years from now or 40 years from now, some benchmark out in the future.
Committee Chairman Tom Lee wants to get a baseline for where water levels are now and where they're projected to be over the next several decades. His proposal makes the Chief Resilience Officer a permanent position in the governor's office, and it creates a task force to put together a projection for sea level rise. The task force idea has support from Audubon of Florida, the Florida League of Cities, and the Sierra Club. Estimates show that at 1 to 3 feet of sea level increase, people will have to get around Miami via boat. Low-lying areas are likely to be underwater, and that will cause people to start moving elsewhere, triggering migrations. Senate President Bill Galvano says he had climate change in mind when he pitched the plan to create 3 new highways, dubbed MCORs.
You know, one of the ideas within even the MCORs program is when we're acquiring mitigation properties that we can look to how those are tying into maintaining the integrity of our coastal communities. So I would stay tuned and see where we go.
Florida's Department of Transportation secretary has also started talking about designing highways for the future. And a proposal by Democratic Senator Jose Javier Rodriguez calls for equipping the state's highways with more electronic vehicle charging stations as a way to adapt to more electronic vehicles and people on the highways. The efforts come after years of silence about climate change from the state's Republican leaders, and Democratic Senator Janet Cruz is pleased to see the turnaround, but she wonders whether it'll be enough.
I think it's really important to note that we are behind the curve on this. You see the king tides rushing in, and to put it in perspective, if you were a young couple that was taking out a 30-year mortgage in Tampa Bay, by the time you paid off that mortgage, the sea level rise would have likely risen 1 to even 2 feet, according to the Tampa Bay Climate Service Advisory Panel. So it's imperative that we get this done.
At least 10 bills filed for the upcoming session target the issue of climate change, sea level rise, and resiliency. Many lawmakers are hoping this year the legislature will get something done. I'm Lynn Hatter in Tallahassee.
Fighting opioid addiction is hard work for anyone, but Regan McCarthy says overcoming drug abuse can be even tougher for people in small towns.
Using medication that eliminates withdrawal symptoms and drug cravings significantly increases the likelihood a person will make it through the detox phase as they fight to get sober.
People in addiction, they have a fear of being dope sick. They have a fear of going through withdrawal. And that fear alone will drive many patients to say, I don't want help at this time. You know, thank you for saving me. I'm ready to leave.
That's Mark Rowley with the Jacksonville Fire Department. He works with a program called Project Save Lives. It helps people recover by pairing them with peer specialists.
Typically what we do is we treat in street. You know, we reverse them with Narcan. We resuscitate them with Narcan. Essentially, we put these patients in withdrawal and they want to go back. And they want to leave. They're in pain. So we try to get that recovery peer specialist right there by the stretcher side, by the bedside, and say, hey, I know what you're going through. I've been there, and guess what? I'm celebrating recovery here. I'm in sobriety, and I can walk this with you. So that's the gold standard of this, is having that recovery peer with shared experience.
Rowley says the next step is getting a person to a detox facility so they can get access to the medicines that mask withdrawal symptoms. But Ute Gaziak, director of substance abuse and mental health for the Florida Department of Children and Families, says those medicines are largely available only in urban areas.
It does provide a huge barrier when you have to every morning get into your car and drive somewhere to be dosed on your medication, especially when some folks have to drive upwards of 2 hours.
The National Institute on Drug Abuse says patients who are given the drug methadone are 4 times more likely to continue treatment than patients who don't receive drugs. But Gaziak says the drug is strictly regulated, since it sometimes can be abused by drug users. Florida requires a needs assessment before a clinic authoring methadone treatment can open. Most rural communities don't have a large enough population to qualify.
Almost all of our methadone clinics are clustered in our more urban areas, which would make sense in terms of population and actually building something, a building that would be supported by enough folks who need it.
A medicine called naltrexone is available in most counties, but it doesn't help much with withdrawal. Instead, it acts as a deterrent by blocking the high people feel when they take opioids. A third drug that can help people fight opioid abuse is called buprenorphine. Prescribing that requires a waiver. Currently, more than 2,000 doctors in the state have received that waiver, but Gaziak says that number is misleading.
That list, unfortunately, never gets updated. So once you're on it for good. If you leave practice, if you retire, if you pass away, your name continues to be on that list.
Gaziak says many of the doctors who are currently practicing aren't accepting new patients. Gaziak and Rowley spoke before a meeting of the state's Opioid Abuse Task Force. Governor Ron DeSantis created the group in April. It's charged with developing best practices for addressing the state's opioid epidemic. I'm Regan McCarthy.
The Tallahassee-based First Amendment Foundation has a new leader. Pamela Marsh took over this month from the retiring Barbara Peterson. Marsh is the former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Florida. She has more than 20 years of legal experience and is a shareholder at the Osley McMullen Law Firm in Tallahassee. Marsh told Gina Jordan this job shares some similarities with her time as both a private and government attorney.
I will still be helping others with the law and interpreting the law and thinking about applying the law to different sets of facts. There's a lot of looking at new legislation, thinking of how bills will affect the public and change the law. So I think my legal training will come in very handy.
So you're taking the helm at the First Amendment Foundation at a time when journalists are being attacked for their work. How will you handle that?
We get our news now in headlines and tweets, and getting deeper into the facts is so important. So one of the things that I think is very important is getting to the real evidence. As we've seen in the hearings recently in Washington, people don't want to know just a summary or just a report that might be from a biased source. They want to see the real facts. They want to hear from a real witness. They want to see the evidence. That's what our public records law and our open government meetings laws really facilitate.
We're talking about how it's important to help journalists dig deeper. The biggest issue may be trying to get the news consumer to be open to everything. Maybe they don't care about that government record you just opened. It's right there on the page and they still don't believe it. That's what we're dealing with today.
I agree. We have to push back on that. We have to work to inform and educate and motivate. We've become so divided because I think the facts don't mean anything. And if you say something three times, somebody's going to believe it. But that's why education is so important. Real solid professional journalism is so important. If you just want to have an opinion, that's not the same thing. But if you really want to understand what's going on, you have to read deeply, and I think you have to participate.
Yeah, question your sources always.
Always. The news is coming in small sound bites. And if you want to know more about it, you have to dig deeper.
So you said that this is a time of learning and Barbara Peterson is still around to help you with this transition. Is there one particular big item on your agenda as you get started?
We are currently looking at about 40 bills that either affect the public records law or the Sunshine Law in some way or have something to do with the First Amendment. So learning that process is probably my biggest challenge. The other thing that I look forward to doing is engaging with many of our other nonprofits. And if we can combine forces, we can do more together.
Students can get a free scholarship now. They can become members for free of the First Amendment Foundation, and that's named for Sandy Dallenbert, who was a huge First Amendment rights attorney and a legend in Florida.
Absolutely.
You mentioned that it doesn't just have to be journalists who are members of this.
Anyone can become a member. We have a hotline that we answer multiple times a day with questions about the public records laws. It's an open book.
Pamela Marsh, new president of the First Amendment Foundation, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
That was Capitol reporter Gina Jordan speaking with the new head of Florida's First Amendment Foundation, Pamela Marsh. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, barely a generation ago, Max Stepanovich was among the most influential Republicans in Florida. His strategic guidance has been largely credited for the latter-day ascendancy of the GOP in the legislature and the governor's mansion. And then along came Donald Trump, and the political landscape changed almost overnight. Stepanovich, a traditional conservative Republican, suddenly became a man without a party. But that apparent isolation hasn't diminished his drive to share his thoughts and concerns. On December 16th, Stepanovich stepped down from the Tallahassee law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney.
Things that I am very concerned about now, politically or otherwise, lead me to say things that are provocative, sometimes controversial, and people who are in business aren't looking for controversy. So my leaving alleviated that risk for them and enhanced my freedom to do what I wanted to.
Stepanovich isn't shy about acknowledging his contribution to the state's political history.
I was fortunate to be able to make a contribution to the growth and eventual dominance of the Republican Party in Florida. When I began, there were no statewide elected Republicans. Both houses of the legislature were controlled by Democrats. And the election of Tampa Mayor Bob Martinez in 1986 was the harbinger of growing Republican power that would eventually resulted in the hegemony you see today.
But he feels both time and the GOP have moved on.
It was a different Republican Party then. It was the party of Ronald Reagan. It was a party that was very forward-leaning on its foreign policy. It was the leader of the free world to whom everyone looked for leadership. It was about personal responsibility, personal accountability. It was about free trade. And to use Reagan's phrase, we were a shining city on the hill.
He believes the plates began shifting beneath the party around 15 years ago.
And rapid changes in the economy worldwide as a transition from an industrial economy to a service economy. Rapid changes in society, cultural issues, whether it's gay rights or whatever. Plus the continued what I call browning of America as white Americans become a smaller and smaller proportion of the population, soon to be a minority.
Stepanovich believes the GOP either didn't or wouldn't respond to these factors in a way that connected with an increasingly disaffected and angry electorate.
Those stresses, that pressure, caused that relatively stable, relatively small minority of crazies in the party to metastasize and become a majority. Donald Trump's genius was, rather than running as a third-party candidate like George Wallace or Ross Perot and losing, he sensed the rot in the Republican Party and hijacked the party of Ronald Reagan.
Now the Republican Party is, for all intents and purposes, the party of President Trump.
He's an isolationist. He's a nativist. He's a protectionist. He's just not a Republican. At least not the Republican Party that I grew up in and knew. One of the ironies is that people like to call folks like me rhinos, Republicans in name only, when I, in fact, believe that Donald Trump is the ultimate rhino. Hell, 9-10 years ago, he was a Democrat.
So at least for now, that's the party that Stepanovich is also affiliating with.
Just this past week, registered as a Democrat so that I can vote in their presidential preference primary, and I intend to vote for the candidate who has the best chance of winning the nomination and the best chance of defeating Donald Trump, which I believe will be the candidate closest to the center.
Can you say Joe Biden? Anyway, former Republican earthshaker Max Stepanovich says he'll be penning periodic op-ed pieces for the Tampa Bay Times going forward and trying to figure out how to help return the party of Trump back to the party of Reagan. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Gainey, Robbie Gaffney, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Happy holidays, and please join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.